The title of this session is Growing Your $800,000 Revenue Practice, right? So I'm sitting here with my firm and we're at about $3.5 million. And then Mission Wealth?
We're at $33 million in revenue.
So just thinking about, as we're going through some of these pieces and some of these strategies, there's stuff that you guys are going to be able to build and deploy right now at $800,000. There's stuff that you're going to be able to deploy at $3.5 million and at $10 million and at $30 million and at $100 million. So there are levels and there's scalability to everything here. So try and think about it in the context of what's going on in my firm today and how do I make that next transition?
Perfect. Well, just quick context, about each of our firms, just to give you a snapshot. Mission Wealth was founded 22 years ago. I co-founded the firm with one other. Today, we have 85 professionals, about a half of which are advisors. We use Angie Huber's Diamond Team, so we have 14 diamonds across the country. We have 25 offices, and we've worked really hard on that whole J-curve of different growth channels. We're going to talk about that. But in the last 2 years, we've brought in over $1 billion of deposits, not counting any market growth. So we've kind of figured out a lot about the growth engine. You are at the $800,000 level.
All right. There we go. All right. So when we're thinking about, the success levels, starting with a vision for your firm. So where do you want to be? And this is, the classic 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year plan, whatever that time scale looks like for you and your firm. If you're looking at scale, how is your business development, marketing, how are your processes going to support that vision for the firm that you want to be on that kind of time scale in the future?
And culture is everything. Even if you have a team of two, like you have a culture, right? And so you want to think about who do I want to be long term? What's my vision for the business? And how can I really cultivate a culture that will support that? So that comes into attracting talent, that comes into retaining existing talent, that comes into how you interact with clients and how you give back in the community. So we can talk about culture. We put a lot into culture at Mission Wealth. So if I could go back to my younger self when we had just two of us, I would have thought a lot more about culture early on and a lot more about systematizing the business early on instead of just building a practitioner model that was just, we had two really good people. I was kind of the front end, good at sales. Brad was great at the back end. And we just hired people around us. And then, of course, what happened as we scaled, we got bottlenecked. So we learned how to improve that. We started by reading different books. E-Myth was the first one that really changed the game for us. We use the EOS, Entrepreneurial Operating System now. But learning how to build systems so that you are not the bottleneck to your business is a key place that you're at. If you're right around 800,000 or a million of revenue, you have to get out of your own way in order to let the team and your systems run the business.
And show of hands, founders in the room. How many? Quite a few. If you are sitting in the seat of central client service, central business development, central marketing and content creator, you are also sitting in the seat of being a single point of failure for your firm. You'll bottleneck it if you don't get out of the way and create systems to allow you to grow beyond yourself. And if something happens to you, or if you make a different change in your life and what you want to do, that's a potential single point of failure for your firm. And that's going to impact your equity valuation. That's going to impact your transition strategy, all of those different pieces. So when we're talking about you need to get out of the way, it's not because you aren't great and amazing and wonderful. You are, because you built something that is wildly successful, but you need to do it to get to that next stage and that next level for you and your team and your firm.
And a great exercise is to think about the six hats that you're wearing, and which of those hats do you love and are you great at, and which of the hats would probably someone else be better at or you don't love doing. And so being able to create an org chart of the firm of the future, say 3 years from now, 5 years from now, and think about the job descriptions and the roles that you ideally would have in this firm and which roles you'd be filling and other team members would be filling. And by the way, they might be different seats on the bus than they currently fill. That was very empowering for us. We had six employees, and I remember we read the E-Myth 2005, and we came up with a 15-person org chart. We thought, wouldn't that be amazing if we went from 6 to 15? We visualized it all, and it was really powerful for us. And we still do that. We still march forward, and we know where we're going to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and how to fill out that org chart based on the vision of where you want to be.
So some of the pieces that are going to allow you to grow, recognizing that you're that concentration risk and that bottleneck, document processes, ways in which you do things, core philosophies. We're going to get into some pieces about how do you take your voice and communicate that to the rest of your team. So it's not how does Seth talk to our clients or about the work that we do, how does the firm talk to our clients and about the work that we do. So the more you can document and train and develop other people to do that, it allows you to move into different roles that you're 15 to 85, there we go.
Yeah.
And then thinking about the resources. So time is involved, potentially vendors, potentially staff. So this requires additional investment as well. And we'll get into some of those.
And shared visioning is really critical. That's something that we still do to this day. We've done early on with the entire team. So we have 85 people. We did our last retreat in Scottsdale. We had a software called Easy Retro Board. I put the eight key categories at the top, and it was like people, it was services, it was investments, it was impact. We had, you know, these top high level categories. Technology was another one. And I gave everyone 2 minutes to crowdsource any idea you think we need to have in people strategy, in tech strategy, to be the firm we want to be 5 years from now. So we had 80 people crowdsourcing. We had 100 ideas. And then I gave everyone 2 minutes to vote for their top three ideas. So we crowdsourced top three ideas across each of those eight core pillars of the business. So everyone felt like they were able to contribute. We're able to kind of have this collective wisdom of the group down to the receptionist to a brand new hire. And that's a way you can still kind of co-vision create with your team as even as your team gets larger. So create shared vision. Don't just be a founder vision. It starts with you, but make sure you incorporate buy-in from everyone else.
Absolutely. And I love that contrast, because we do our quarterly meetings as well with our team, and we're doing it differently because we don't have 85 people. We have 15. We're still small enough. We can physically get in one mm-hmm. room, and we're going through, here are the key objectives for the firm during this next time period. Here are wins and losses that we've had as a team. How do we want to approach those issues? And then we break out into subgroups where each one is taking on what are their quarterly rocks that they're going to be moving forward for the organization in the next 90 days. And we have a mechanism to be able to follow up. So again, everything scales. Our solution at 15 people does not work at 85. And wherever your firm is at today, it's about getting around a shared vision and how do you guys collaborate and make sure that it's not just coming from your brain as the founder into execution mode by everybody else.
So I think now we're going to talk about growth channels. You know, Michael Kitts has talked about growth channels. Figuring out where your growth channels are really critical. We focus on 5 organic growth channels plus M&I, mergers and integrations. We have 6 growth channels. So it's a traditional client referrals. It's centers of influence. We'll give some best ideas there. We also have the custodial referral platform, Fidelity and Schwab, that we have referrals from. I guess that would be under sponsor, under Kitsis. We have digital marketing, and then we have direct, right? When you're on a board or coaching soccer and you meet other people directly. So thinking about your growth channels and thinking about which ones you really have pumping today and which ones you'd like to expand, and then coming up with some strategic initiatives around those. I'm happy to talk about any of those 6 channels and some ideas there. 2 quick ideas. I want to give just like best ideas across the first 2 organic. As far as client referrals, through our CRM, which is Salesforce, which we created customized dashboards, we label every client as a goldmine or a landmine client. So a goldmine client is a client that's referred us at least once, if not twice before. They're an advocate for our service. We have great relationships with them, and we invest in them as goldmine clients. A landmine client is someone who maybe you've tried, or they're just not the type to really refer. So put your effort into your goldmine clients, put a lot of resource, because they can keep referring, and there's a tremendous opportunity there. And then on this, we'll go to COIs next. Did you want to touch on the first one, client referrals at all?
Yeah, I think we are not doing goldmine and landmine, but I totally want to steal that because that's genius. But we're continuing to mine the data for us and saying, great, where are our client referrals coming from? How do we want to continue to empower those great referral clients? Do we want to do a bring a friend event? Do we want to do an affinity based thing? So we are systematizing it and utilizing that data very much the same.
Right. So centers of influence, there's a lot of strategies there. A really simple one that can scale easily is, anyone here use Holistiplan? Okay, wow, a lot of you use Holistiplan. So they have a tax letter that can be sent automatically to your client's CPAs, and it can come from you, the advisor. So it's over here. And so it will summarize, you know, did we fund a donor advised fund? Was there a Roth conversion? What were the losses harvested? It gives kind of a summary of the tax impact for the year. So that can automatically be sent to the CPA from Mary, recognizing the work that you've done for the client, and that can be automated. So that's something that our team automatically sends out to every COI across all of our 42 advisors. And that's software, right? That's an easy push.
And similarly, if any of you were in Tiffany's COI session, she's really gotten this down to an art form about how do you engage with those centers of influence that you're working with on behalf of your clients? How do you make sure that you remain top of mind, that we're clear about who we work with and how we best service? So we've tended to do this a little bit more manually, where we're executing tracking of different COI relationships. And I can show you an example of that as well. So this is Tiffany's COI tracking sheet. And again, this is an Excel doc. So it lives there and it gets updated inside Redtail periodically, which is our CRM. But what we're trying to understand is, do we actually know these COIs, and are we going to be able to connect with them in a meaningful way consistently over time, whether it's Tiffany doing that connection, or now we're pushing a lot of that down to our lead advisors. So we call this the baseball card. She's able to push the baseball card to them and say, great, here's everything that you need to know about collaborating with the COI so that you can be really effective and step in there and do that. So something that you can certainly implement on your own in your own practice if you're not already doing so.
And I love this. I'm going to borrow this from you all. And I would challenge you, it's not Tiffany's, it's Destiny Capital's.
Very true. Very true.
Talking about bottlenecking, right? So maybe we go to the next slide. I don't know if we have an example of our COI. So what we do with COIs is we will give case studies. So we have different types of client personas we work with. It might be executives around concentrated stock. It might be women in transition, divorce, widows. It might be professionals, retirees. And so we will come up with case studies that are real Mission Wealth case studies. We keep them anonymous. And then we will share those with the family law attorney, for instance, and say, here's how we work with the divorce, during divorce, post-divorce, here's the resources, here's how we'd like to collaborate with you, how would you like to collaborate with us? So being able to have those conversations with COIs in their area of specialty and show them that you know how to work with these types of shared clients, and that will bring them up, that will help them start to think, gosh, I have some other clients that could use some work, and I haven't heard other advisors talking about how we can partner together in the same way. So case studies and sharing those with COIs is a really effective strategy to cultivating that channel.
And I think on the technologically advanced side, maybe we can move to your next one on your dashboard as well.
Sure. So, we talked a lot about the importance of measurement. So when it comes to your growth funnel, when it comes to anything, your service delivery, we have four tiers of clients at Mission Wealth. We track all the service delivery across those four, 0 to 1 million, 1 to 5 million, 5 to 20 million, and 20 million plus is our family office. We know what needs to be delivered for each of those tiers to be happy. It's always painful when you overserve a small client, but it's even more painful when you underserve a large client and they leave because they said, well, I was looking for literacy education for my kids, and I was looking for help on social security analysis. And you're like, well, I do that. Well, we didn't know because you didn't offer it. This shows kind of the key dashboards we look at all the time through Salesforce. So it kind of tracks, first, this is lead advisor. So we use the diamond model where a lead advisor is spending 80% of their time on business development. Each of our lead advisors bring in between 40 to 100 million a year in new deposits across those 14 diamonds. So this just tracks, okay, what are the revenue sources from our different lead advisors? And then we have client advisors. This is outside assets that they're bringing in. So, year to date, we brought in 750 million in outside assets from just servicing clients well and bringing in outside assets, and 600 million in new lead advisor business. Actually, it's over 800 million now. So we're tracking to do 1.3 billion this year in deposits. And we're tracking how each of those 14 lead advisors are performing. We're giving them resources. We're tracking how our other 36 client advisors are performing, giving them resources. And we're able to track it so we can see if someone's outperforming. Wow, Wes is doing a great job at getting COI referrals. Wes, why don't you share with the other advisors what's working for you? So being able to cross share, and maybe your team's not large enough to do that, but through Limitless, you have a lot of resources and peer groups that you can cross share some of these best ideas. But you have to track it to know what's happening. Yes. These are individuals. So the question is, what do the colors represent? These are all representing individuals and their results.
So I think a key takeaway from this is sort of the high end of the build out, because you need to track all of this data because it goes into individual performance metrics by position. You're looking at conversion rates across different channels based on advisor. Is advisor A more successful with channel one than advisor two is? What does that tell us about training, about different things that we're doing? If we scale this back to where you're at in your business, we're utilizing the opportunity section inside Redtail. So we're still tracking all of that data, but we've taken a different approach where the firm is responsible for marketing and sourcing of new business, and actually completes the getting the client to contract before they go to an advisor. So we have one dashboard because that suits our model. We're still tracking where everybody's at in terms of the stage, what our conversion rates are, what our sources are, all of that. So when you're thinking about how do I remove myself from being the central hub in this process, it's looking at what kind of data do you need from your team so that you and your leadership team can be informed and make really good decisions. And that should be tailored to where your firm's at today. All right, so looking at the elements of a digital marketing plan, we've got an example of the limitless content calendar over here. So now we're moving from the, you recognize your bottleneck, you need to get out of your own way. How do you actually do that on the market? Marketing side, and a big piece of that is having an actual marketing plan, which doesn't just exist in your brain.
And being intentional, and I was with FICOM, they were talking about, you know your authentic self, know who you connect with, and be willing to share your personal story. So it doesn't have to be institutionalized. I mean, I think it's really powerful to have your voice in the firm shared with clients. When it comes to marketing strategy, we have that really nailed down across those five. And we're able to use software, Pardot, which is tied into Salesforce, which is able to track all of the engagement that anyone has. So this person read the newsletter, this person clicked the video, this person hit social media, this person, maybe they haven't even reached out, but we know what's happening behind the scenes, their level of engagement, to then know where to put additional outreach efforts. So, what are the advantages of scale? Some of the advantages of scale is that you're able to tap into better software, better systems, specialization. So we have a 4-person marketing team that just does this full time. So that's, that's where you can go. And it starts with maybe hiring a part-time marketing person, right? You just like an outsourcer person. That can be step one. Hiring FICOM or another consultant to come in to do an hour's, assessment of your current marketing strategy. So just getting outside expertise, because again, as financial advisors, we weren't trained in marketing, right? We're mostly numbers people. So it's great to get feedback from folks in their right brains.
And just like the business development side on the marketing, you're tracking your data. So you've moved from this place of you're the one executing to now you've empowered your team plus vendors, plus tech tools to be able to execute on your behalf. How do you know whether you're being effective? So I love a drool over the system that Mission has in terms of tracking, like by unique user, how are they engaging with different things that we're doing? Pull back to our level, and we're still looking at click-through rates, open rates, forward rates on different pieces of content. And so we're not able to isolate down to the individual person, but we're looking at broadly, is this piece effective? Was the piece about this topic more effective than this one? If so, we can redirect our efforts. So wherever you're at, just think about what are the key pieces of data which will allow you to be informed on whether your marketing plan is actually effective.
And now getting into kind of approaches to marketing, we're here, having a larger marketing team, but I still write a very personal message, very kind of philosophical message for each of our newsletters that's very human based. So it's great to institutionalize and talk about markets and whatnot, but being able to just still have that like one-on-one voice, like you're speaking to one client at a time. That's why they hired you in the first place. So keep that alive in your marketing. Even if you do build out videos or newsletters or blogs or podcasts, it's that human to human connection that really counts.
And you were telling me a story about what your most effective piece of content has been over the past year. What was that?
Well, if you click the next slide, we actually have an image of it. So we do a lot of fun kind of human interest stories. And so this was like a recent one, Father's Day. We had a number of our advisors talk about their first money memory with their father, or what they feel they've tried to do as a father themselves to their kids with regard to money relationships. And we had them just share a video. And it was interesting because when this came out, we just did a big economic push, and we had key people from Blackstone and Goldman and giving all this great insight, which you think would be like, everyone wants to know what's going on with the economy. It was forward forecast. And this little Father's Day video had like 5x the views of our whole firm-wide economic output, because people love human interest stories, right? So I'd say it doesn't have to be big technical, spend a lot of time preparing, tell some stories and put them on a video and share them with your community. They'll land.
Allison, are you trying to get something to play here?
I'm trying to get it to play, yes.
They can watch it later. That's fine.
And
I'll just co-founder and chief impact officer with Mission Wealth. And it's my pleasure to give a big happy Father's Day to all the dads in our Mission Wealth community. I've absolutely loved being a dad to my daughter and my son. And today,
why don't we just share the link with them later? That's fine. Yeah.
Perfect. And I'm not seeing the other image come up here. We're kind of stuck on the slideshow. So I do my video message from the CEO. So it's 90 seconds to 3 minutes maximum. I'm doing them outside. I'm doing them handheld with my iPhone entirely intentionally so that clients can continue to see me and connect with me, because I'm out of the vast majority of our client interactions and our client meetings. But I'm trying to, that's really zoomed in. Yeah. I promise it doesn't look like that when we sent it to them. It's a little
I feel
more...
like Big Brother's looking over me. It's like...
So that creepy video actually works and it's really nice for clients. So again, thinking about our audience and how we want to engage with them and what do we want to communicate for our clients, about a plan strategy, it's money and meaning, right? So
continue what you're saying though about your video. You said you sent out something outside and held
iPhone. Yes. I'm just holding my iPhone intentionally to make it look low tech and low production value. iPhones are great, the picture's great, the audio's great, even if you're just holding it. But I wanted it to come across as like, this is not a produced packaged version of me. This is authentic. I'm out running. I'm at the beach. I'm at the park with my kids, whatever. I grabbed my phone and I sent a message to the clients. It says, money and meaning. We care about you. We want you to be living life, right? That's the messaging that we want to hit. And that's what's effective for us. Probably wouldn't be effective for Mission. They might go, why isn't this more produced? Aren't you guys like big enough to do this properly? So thinking about what's your medium and how do you want to communicate? And you can do that and enable others to be able to share that and carry that message forward without you having to do it as the founder. Let's get that guy off the screen.
That's what I was waiting for.
All right. So again, just in the effort of how do we take what's in our brain as the founder that a lot of clients know, and how do we make sure that if someone else is going to write a communication piece, or if they're going to reach out to the client about a topic, how do we know what the voice of the firm is? You have to tell them. You have to tell them, this is the way Destiny Capital talks about this topic with clients. Here are the words that we choose to use, and here are the words that we avoid, because words have meaning and they can create emotions. So we have our brand style guide, and we talk about, you know, if we're, these are our themes, we're empowering, we're understanding, we're visionary, we're secure. We want to be really calm and positive. That's kind of our MO as a firm. Others might be more action oriented and, you know, hey, we've got to do things. We got to move. There's opportunity here. It's all about your style and your voice. And so we had to write all of that out. And that's part of our style guide that our team gets trained on and they can refer to.
Being caring is one of our top four core values. And so we'll talk about how can you communicate with people in a caring way. Like as advisors, this is something that we're really great at. We have high EQ typically, and we're able to really listen empathetically. But I will, at our retreats, lead a communication coaching exercise. So our last one in Scottsdale, we had a breakout group where we had everyone partner up with someone they didn't know. And we talked about the three levels of communication. Level one, the lowest, is communicating for your reply. Oh, I'm going to say this as soon as they're done. That's not the best level. Level two is communicating to understand. And level three is listening to reply, listening to understand. And then level three is listening for what's not being said. Right? And so then we practice that one-on-one. So really thinking about communication, which is the key part of our business. And we know that 55% of communication is nonverbal. 38% is paralanguage, how we speak quiet, fast, loud. And then only 7% of the words. So be really mindful of how your team is communicating, whether it's in person or via video, with all the dimensions of communication.
right. So we did want to leave about half the time here for Q&A, and I think we'll be right on time. But I think our central message for both of our firms is growth is not a solo sport. You do not do this yourself. There is no superhero founder, CEO who's going to go make it all happen for the firm. And so thinking about how you get you onto paper and over to your team and train so that you do have that voice of, this is what Destiny Capital does for its clients. This is what Mission Wealth does. Here's what we stand for. Here's what we commit to you to serve and to be like. It's really important to get that stuff off of you.
And setting rules. Like, I was biz dev, you know, initially, and Brad was kind of back office. And so I was just used to kind of telling the story and being the inbounding person, and grew the first billion that way, and then realized that the big bottleneck was me, and Brad had other forms of bottleneck. So we set a rule. I'm not allowed to be in meetings alone. That was like a rule, because then you get bonded, and then the client wants to work with you, and then you don't have capacity to meet someone else and to run the firm, et cetera. So then it became really broken down. I could be in the open meeting. In the second meeting, the email summary from the meeting comes from the other advisor who was in the meeting with me, and then I'm CC'd. Then the second meeting, I'm in there, but I let them start a little early, and then I come in and I let them kind of have a greater than 50% of a voice, which was sometimes hard because I wouldn't take over, right? So I let them, and then the follow-through was just from the other advisor. And then the third meeting, they run it, I just pop and say hello, and then I'm out. So we had set rules of how to really, you know, take out the person who might be the bottleneck person in your firm. You might think about that. Like, how can I actually create some guardrails? Because left to my own devices, I'm going to get my own way because it's what I do. So we came up with some rules, and it worked really well. And you want to empower others, right? That's the whole goal. You want to empower others. That's our business, is we're here to, you know, raise up those around us. And I always like to think, like, our job as CEOs is to be the chief energy officer, right? So we're here to make other people's eyes shine, whether it's a teammate, a prospect, a client, a vendor. So we're here to talk to them, to listen to them, to connect with them in a way that their eyes shine. And if you're looking at one of your teammates and their eyes are dull, you're not doing your job as a chief energy officer, right? So look at their eyes, be ultra aware of everyone else and where they're at when you're talking to them. And your job is to inspire and to uplift. That's your primary job as a chief energy officer. All right, questions?
Let me see if this is on.
So at what point in your practice, obviously, did you realize that you need someone else to help? And, you know, the old traditional model is, you know, behind me kind of thing. How did you compensate that first person once you brought them on? And what role did that person play? A paraplanner, that sort of thing?
I'll start. So it was Brad and myself. The first person we hired was a receptionist, like someone to kind of admin help. So the question was, how did we know when to hire our first person, our second person? So there was two of us. I had a co-founder, and we started, and we hired kind of an admin person. And then our next hire was a client advisor. We needed someone to like handle some of the handholding because we were really focused on growth. And then from there, it wasn't long. We were at, you know, just six people, 5 years in, where we then read the E-Myth and said, let's create this org chart. And we came up with 15 job descriptions, and we figured out which one of those was the most important. We had six of the 15 already, so how do we fill in those other nine? And we prioritized each of those nine to fill in, and we slowly worked our way to hire. And it's always a challenge, right? Because you're trying to build profitability, but you have to keep investing in the growth and the hires and the infrastructure. That J curve kind of just seems to be perpetually running. Anyone can relate to that, right? The perpetual J curve. So, but there, it's so critical to get people that can do work that maybe you can do fine, but you don't love, and that they can love. And then you can be freed up to do more of where your genius is. So we had that whole pathway, and we hired someone in the investments eventually. We didn't hire marketing right away. And then when we learned about the diamond model, that made a ton of sense to us to how we wanted to structure our team. So our goal was to get to four advisors and have the lead advisor, who's focused on 80% of their time on biz dev. That was gonna be me. The client, a senior client advisor who's a technician, was Brad, my co-founder. We hired this other, and then we said, we need an associate. We need a pair planner that we can train up, who can kind of sit in meetings, populate the Money Guide Pro and eMoney plans. And so then we hired an associate, and that was our first diamond. And then from there, we hired someone from the investment team, more ops, and it just kept growing.
And I think, you know, what I'm hearing from Seth here is they started with the vision. Where do we want to be, right? We're at 6 right now. We think we're going to be at 15. What's the sequencing that we need to do there? So I came in as a G2. I was employee number 7. I was the first non-founder advisor who was on the team. And we spent quite a few years with me just kind of learning along the way. But we had a very similar process where we said, great, we want to be an enduring enterprise, and our internal mission is to create a place where talented, motivated people can achieve their career and life aspirations. So if we wanted to execute on that, it became necessary for us to grow and scale so that the success of the firm was not contingent on any 1, 2, or 3 individual people. So we looked at that from a vision standpoint and said, great, how are we going to get there? How do we need to organize the team? And we did the very similar thing. What's our org chart? Where do the competencies lie now? Where do we need them to be? Where do we need the degree of specialization? So it's very customized, but I would always start with what's the vision? Who do you want to be?
And you should be excited by that vision. So like, we're really excited. We know by 2030, we'll be at 30 billion with 36 diamond teams. We know how many offices, we know the types of people we need in ops, et cetera. We look at the best practice benchmarks of revenue per professional. We're at 357,000 revenue per professional now. We're always tracking those benchmarks that Michael talked about. We've invested 10%+ in marketing because we knew the ROI was significant. So you have to just keep working on it as a business and not getting caught up so much as a practitioner. That, I would say that's like the top thing. Unless you want to be that lifestyle practitioner model, which is fine, but those are the folks that probably aren't sitting in on this course. If you want to go from 800 to 1.6 to, you know, 3 million in revenue, you have to start thinking about getting yourself out of the way of being the practitioner mindset. And you're now running a business, you're growing a business, and you're the, you know, strategist behind it. So you got to play chess intentionally.
Okay, question from online. From Tara, any advice on how you find the right people to join your team?
You want to start?
Sure. Going to our network. So getting more specialized in terms of our roles, and not asking people to do B+ work in 10 areas, we want them to do A+ work in like 2 or 3 areas, has really simplified our recruiting. So we have an exact picture of who we want. We utilize DISC as part of our process as well to just look at, you know, personality fit. DISC is not the end all be all. I know everybody has their own thing. It's a tool, it's part of the process. And then we go to network and we say, here's very specifically who we're looking for. Here's our core values as a firm. Here's our financial planning philosophy. Here's our investment management philosophy. Who do you know that's in your network that could really use an introduction here? And we'd love to have the conversation. We've really not utilized recruiters in the past year and a half, and getting clear is what's enabled us to do that effectively.
And having a culture that's so attractive that people want to join you, right? So investing in culture will be investing in your recruitment of talent. And we also have used recruiters, but we also have grown a lot through mergers and integrations. So right now we're growing a lot of our talent through partnering with other firms that say, hey, we want to grow too. We don't want to build out the departments. We would like to expand, you know, together instead of apart. So thinking about who your ideal candidates are, what qualities do they have, and how aligned are they with your culture and your core values will help attract the right type of people to you.
You mentioned 8 pillars. What was that in reference to? Your 8 pillars?
I'm sorry, I think I was talking about 6 channels of growth.
8 core pillars of the business.
Oh, yes. That was just a strategy brainstorming that I did. It's not like we always talk about the 8. I came up with 8 that were relevant to us. It was people, technology, investments, it was impact, it was growth. I can't remember. That's not like a normal. It was just like for an exercise, I came up with 8.
Okay.
Yeah. We do talk about 11 dimensions of life, though. We can talk about 11 dimensions.
Okay, so as the G2 and the person that's coming in, what do you recommend? Like, what do you see whenever you hire someone, when you're like, oh, you're doing great, this is exactly what I want you to do, this is moving the needle a lot. Like, what can, and for people that are hiring, like, what can you tell them to focus on to make the most difference in the growth channel and all that?
I think it's going to be very specific to your firm and how you guys have grown. Typically, anybody who's newer and coming in, whether you're hiring biz dev or a G2 advisor, however you do that, if you have a pre-existing developed sales channel and a process that they can step into and work, they're always going to be more effective than kind of the classic model of there's the wilderness, go find something to kill, and you know, it'd be great if you bring that back. So I think looking at what do you need them to do as a firm is really going to govern what you want to ask them to do.
For us, we have a career ladder that really paints that picture. And we think it's great when founders paint the picture to the young hire or the G2. We have G5 now, so we're under our fifth generation at Mission Wealth. But the G2 person that comes in, it's important that ideally there's a G1 or G2A and their G2B that they could speak to that's a year ahead of them, 3 years ahead of them, 5 years ahead of them. We found there was a big gap when it's like, I'm 52 and I'm talking about a 24-year-old about where how they can grow within the company. It's great if they can talk to a 27-year-old, a 31-year-old, and 34-year-old, right? So they can see people closer to their age and see how they've, okay, we have this career ladder. How's the career ladder work? Have they gone from associate to client advisor to lead advisor to partner? How long did that take you? What resources did you need to excel? We have a mentorship program, so every 6 months we rotate mentors to all of our G2 and below. So they're able to talk to their peers, and that's really valuable.
And one of the things I'd really recommend as you're looking at scaling your firms and your practices is getting very clear on the performance standards and metrics for your team by 2, 3, 4 system lead advisors. And so 1 is inconsistent, 2 is somewhat, 3 is consistent, and 4 is like always excellent. And so we have that conversation every 90 days where we're talking about, hey, here's, you know, this interaction or this outcome that, you know, really is representative of where you're at this quarter. What do you want to work on in the next quarter? What does the firm need you to work on? So that we can have a data-backed conversation that's recorded. And so I think in the business development context, if you have very clear standards around, hey, in years 0 to 2, here's what we need you to be doing and successful at, but in years 3 to 4, here's our expectation, you can help manage some of that development for them.
And a challenge we've had as we've gotten larger is we have 14 diamonds, and we find that a young associate comes in and they're really shaped by the diamond that they're in. So if a lead advisor is into alt, they're going to get access to an alt strategy. If they're into ESG, or if they're into inspired living and more kind of holistic conversations, they're going to be shaped by that. So for us, we're really needing to make sure that we cross-pollinate best ideas. And we now have 2 full-time people who are chief client officers to share best practices across those 14 diamonds to make sure that they're getting exposure outside of their region that they're, you know, living in every day. So it's kind of stepping outside the cohort group to make sure they get exposure across the broader. Hey, great questions. What else? We're happy to answer anything. Same with virtual land. You can type into the chat if you have any questions. We'd love to answer them. Building teams, culture. Yes.
So what, you said content to COIs. How about the cases? What else? How do you stay connected with COIs?
Repeat the
so the question was, how do you stay connected with COIs outside of sharing case studies? Seth, do you want to?
Well, just one idea is we do a lot of volunteer programs. And so I always invite my closest COIs when I do volunteer programs. So last Saturday, we did a coastal cleanup, beach cleanup across all of our California offices. We invited key COIs to come do that. We do these inspired living programs where we'll bring a speaker in who's like Dan Buettner talking about health and wellness, or a top psychologist or a top purpose person, Chip Conley, and we'll invite our COIs to these classes that really have nothing to do with financial planning. It's really more like life planning. So think about things that you naturally do on your own that you think of being separate from your work because you just love to volunteer with kids or you love to go to art studios. Anything that you're passionate about, one of your COIs probably shares that passion. So I've always been blending my personal with the business. And that's how you develop relationships. Be authentic, be vulnerable, invite them to things that you're interested in, and you'll start to build relationships there.
And also thinking about their calendar and in their world. So with our CPA COIs, we do a lot of different stuff where we're bringing goodies into their office around different key dates in the tax compliance season. It's just a way to be able to have, you know, a quick touch that says, hey, we were thinking about you. We know this is a busy moment for you. So there's some really low hanging fruit ideas to stay top of mind. If you're thinking about what does the annual cycle look like for each of your different COIs, you may have personal trainers, you may have real estate brokers, you may have different people that you're not thinking of as the standard like CPA and attorney, and what's going on in their life and how do you engage with that?
Psychologists, therapists, life coaches, there's a lot of COIs out there. They're not just, you know, attorneys and accountants.
Yeah, if you could provide more color on, you went from 6 to 15 in your ideal org chart early on, and
sort of, were you adding a second dotted team, or what were the pieces you needed to add to grow there, and what were your milestones on revenue, where you were and where you needed to be with the team?
Right. So you know, adopting the Diamond model gave us a structure, which was great. And part of that structure is a career ladder. So you get an associate, you should never hire an associate unless they don't really have the aspiration to become a client advisor. Ideally, you don't want them just to stay in that land forever. So if they are successful and you're supporting them the way you should be, they will become a client advisor. And then you'd hire another associate there. And some might stay in that client advisor role, but some of them might say, gosh, I would love to go out there and do new business. I'd love to go out there and tap into one of those growth channels that fills a line for me. And so it was really, we were forced from a employee desire. We had someone who was a super bright client advisor who's like, I want to do sales. I want to do biz dev. I think I can do it. I'm like, yeah, he was great. So I'm like, well, we got to create a diamond for him. It's boom. So it was really based on that, that we created this second diamond. And then we knew that he was over here. We had to hire an associate. So we hired a really smart young woman out of college. She was there to be his associate because it was just following the path, because we committed back to our culture. We're going to take care of our people. We have a growth mindset, and we're going to always try to provide the best support we can for them and for clients and for the community. So we started that, and that just keeps growing, right? That diamond grows, and it just like planting seeds. It just starts, the garden starts to flourish. As far as revenue, our diamonds all have somewhere between 2 to 4 million of revenue per diamond. So they'll start off, and they might be 500,000 of revenue to a million of revenue. Basically the size of maybe some of the firms here. But we know, again, every diamond is growing by no less than 40 to 50 million a year. That's a brand new diamond that hasn't even been seasoned. All of our seasoned diamonds are growing by more like 80 to 100 million a year. So because of that growth, we have to keep expanding, because we deliver updated financial plans for every client every year. We deliver proactive service across those four tiers. You have to have advisor capacity and ops capacity to support that client experience, because you don't want to have such a growth engine that you then sacrifice on the back end and don't keep retention super high. So for us, it was like understanding the revenue needed, how to manage the growth, and how to keep up with capacity. And that's where the numbers matter, so you can be tracking all that. Great question. What other questions? Who here feels overwhelmed by everything they've heard at this conference, and then you're going to go back to all your client emails and calls and go, what do I do first? Like, what's the low-hanging fruit? Give me three things. I know what that's like. So please ask us any question. We're happy to hopefully make this meaningful.
We could do a group solve as well. If somebody's at a point where you're stuck on a particular issue, workshop it right now. We got the time.
Great opportunity. Do we have anyone from virtual land? I see Sheena there. Jocelyn, Tara, Todd. What questions do any of you have? Ben, Mark, we're happy to answer any question, something you're thinking about. Chad.
So remember, this is talked about a number of times, like, you know, people, the banker or whatever, that all of a sudden they get into it because they love banking, but now all of a sudden they're a business owner. It has kind of blown my mind how much every one of y'all are no longer really that involved.
Do you miss that aspect?
Great question. So from eMyth, they talk about the baker who has a passion for baking, and then before you know it, she's busy doing inventory and sales and, you know, sourcing product and not actually baking. So do I miss having that one-to-one client experience? You know, I do, but I'm able to get enough of it. I can pop in. So I'm leading a lot of our Inspired Living work. So when a client has a big life event and they need, you know, they need to refine themselves, they just sold their company, they've just gone through a divorce, I will pop in and provide that kind of extra coaching, which is the work I really love doing. I don't miss doing the financial plans and all that work, Money Guy Pro. I mean, I did it for years. I've done thousands of financial plans. So for me, it was a good fit to do work that felt really meaningful. And I love building our team. I love focusing on culture. I love partnering with other firms. So, and it's fun to keep reinventing ourselves. Like we can rinse and repeat and do what we've done for 10, 20 years plus, or you can reinvent yourself. So part of having a growth mindset is staying curious, staying open, and being willing to fail. And so I adopt that, our firm adopts that. So we're constantly trying to push people. One person was in marketing, now she's leading tech. Someone was on the investment team, now he's over on the financial team. So I think it's great to reinvent ourselves. And I think it's good to stretch our limits and to not just stay where we're comfortable. Growth is where we're uncomfortable.
I would agree. You know, I've described it as like running the $1 million retirement planning client. Like once you've done that enough, it's like those adjustable height basketball hoops. when you're 12 and you put it down to 6 feet and you can windmill dunk, like that's really fun. And you want to windmill dunk again and again. And after about an hour of that, you're like, maybe I should move the hoop up because this is a little, it's a little easy. I'm no longer challenged in doing it. It doesn't mean that I don't see the value in really good retirement planning for those million-dollar clients. It needs to be done. It's desperately important to them and their families, and you change lives. I do not disagree with any of that, but I think for me, I needed that continual challenge where I said, I want a team that can deliver those plans and those values to those clients over and over and over and do it better than I would be able to, because they're more passionate about it at this point than I am. So I think it's just, again, choosing those different challenges to continue stretching individually. This is the challenge that I've chosen, and the CEO seat is really, really hard. But I love the challenge. So,
and there's nothing wrong if your passion is doing the client work. You're like, I don't like biz dev. I love taking great care of these families and getting to know the next generation and getting to know their centers of influence. You know, we have advisors who are top partners of ours who are our highest paid employees, are our client advisors. They make more than me. And they are doing a great job of holding down 60 to 80 relationships and delivering tremendous value. And that's what they love. They don't want to do biz dev. They don't want to run the business. They don't want to think about partnerships across the country. That's what they love. So it's finding what do you love and then leaning into that and trying to get rid of all the other stuff that you don't love as much so your genius can shine more. Good question. Yeah.
You want us to use this mic?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. I took the leap from in 2014, 2015 of hiring my first advisor, and I was terrified to do it. And I thought, you know, I didn't like the idea of doing the 80-20 thing because I was worried that clients would come and say, oh, you only work with rich people now. And so I had this idea that, you know, maybe I'll just assign all my clients to the advisor. Kind of went the opposite extreme. It didn't go well. I ended up losing like $350,000 of revenue. And we've been kind of clawing back to $1 million now. And I've had three other advisors, two I've fired, one we parted ways, one actually a fourth one followed her boyfriend to Connecticut and got married. But how do you, I kind of piggyback off somebody's question back there about, it's one thing to trust somebody and hire the right person to take on 80% of the clients that only account for 20% of the revenue. If they're gone, they're gone, no big deal. But to take the next step that you did, where then you go from, because I would love that. I mean, I'm kind of bored, honestly. Yeah, I hope this isn't recorded. In public.
only a few thousand people watching. It's fine.
I've learned that I love the things that I can lose at. Yeah. And I feel like referrals are easy. They're boring. I feel like I want to grow in ways I can lose because it's a challenge. And it's so the competition's fun. The stock market's fun because I can lose. I lose all the time. So I'm curious how you took, first of all, the first leap in a way that you could trust the staff, your advisory staff, to take on these clients and not A, screw you, or B, leave and take clients with them. And then that next step above and beyond where you're like, all right, I'm giving the whole farm away to try and grow this thing. Yeah. So
that's a great question. Well, you know, for us, it's been incremental. So an associate, so when we have, you know, a diamond team, we're constantly pushing smaller clients down to the associate advisor. And then the two client advisors are holding down usually 60 to 80 relationships. And then the lead advisor has maybe 30, 40 max relationships. There's constant transference of clients across those four and sometimes to other diamonds. Basically, the client might move to Texas, so we want to move them to the Texas diamond. So being incremental would be one. Two is you have to take time to make sure that they are trained and empowered to do the work effectively. And that doesn't mean that they'll do it exactly the way you do it, right? And that was one of my first challenges is I'm a perfectionist at writing. Like I hate typos, they drive me crazy. And so I was like, oh, I was just like editing the heck out of them and I wasn't empowering them because, and then in meetings, I've criticized them because I said, you got to handle it this way. And so like being a parent, I had to learn how to be more nurturing and empowering. And if I really wanted them to shine, I had to let them shine in their own way, which is different from my way. So maybe thinking about, you know, what are the deal breakers that they have to do to be able to deliver to the clients in an effective way? And do you have workflows and have you broken that down? And then do some training with them. Start with your small clients. Let them handle 5-6 relationships, smaller clients. See how that goes. Pop in, give them some mentoring, and then medium level clients. And then so you incrementally wean yourself from that day-to-day service. I mean, carte blanche is, that's a high risk. It's probably kind of thrilling for a moment. I'm free. And you're like, oh crap, I'm not free. Yeah.
Yeah, And I think what you hear in that is that those are clients of Mission Wealth. They may be serviced by Jamie over here, and then maybe they need to be serviced by Alice next, right? But like the value proposition of the Mission Wealth service model continues. So you can institutionalize that so that whoever you bring in, you're making a promise to the client that says, we as a firm do this, and I'm committing to you that we hire, develop, and train really good people, and they're going to do it in the same way that I would. Not exactly the same, but the value is going to be delivered in the same way. And then there's some training and development things you can do there. So like on our advisor career path, we have, if you're going to go from a senior coordinator into a strategist, so like a lead advisor role, there's a period of time where the lead advisor designates 25 clients that senior coordinator is now the lead relationship manager for, while the strategist is still responsible for client retention and client service metrics on that. So there's a trust element there where there's, I'm directly responsible for mentoring and supervising, and this person is now ready to take this, and I'm willing to kind of stake part of our team and our outcomes on their success. So we've instituted that so that it's not a hard stop. It's not a, hey, congratulations, you're a lead advisor, here's 100 clients. You kind of get a period of time to be able to assess, is this really being effective? So there's some organizational design things you can do there. And then you also talked about somebody screwing you and leaving. You can work on that on, client employment agreements and different contracts. And there's some organizational design stuff that you can do there.
I want to take a couple questions from the virtual community. Sheena asked us, she said, hey, how long does it take to move from the starting position in the diamond to the client service advisor? And where do they have the most success finding talent? So for us, the client advisor associate comes in, and within 2 years, they should graduate, they should get their CFP, and they should be ready to move to client advisor. The longest should be 3. If it goes beyond 3, then they're probably not going to last in the organization, because that means that they really don't have it. If they've failed their CFP 3 times in a row, and they just aren't learning the software, and they have a hard time communicating with clients, then maybe we move them to a compliance team or investment team or tech team. They're probably not going to be client facing. So 3 years on the outset would be my answer to how long it takes. And then from there, we kind of see how they operate in that client advisor role. We typically try to have complementary client advisors on each diamond. One might be more technical, investment centric, the other one might be more financial planning. One might be male, one might be female, one might be older, one might be younger. We try to make a balancing act so we can kind of provide more balance to each of those diamonds. Whether they decide to go from that client advisor role to a lead advisor role is really up to them. So there's no timeline on that. It depends on their age too. So sometimes we get young people that come in and they're just like chomping at the bit and they want to make partners as quick as possible. They want to get to lead advisor as soon as possible. We typically have them stay in a client advisor role for no less than 2 years. So we want them to have at least 2 years of delivering the cooking, understanding the value of the financial planning before we put them in a sales role. So 2 years and 2 years is kind of the quickest it would be accelerated to lead advisor. And then how quickly can they make partner? We've had people make partner within 2 years. And we have 19 partners today. We're going to be naming 6 additional, and then 2 others are coming in through mergers and integrations. So we'll be at 26 partners by January. So we keep widening the ownership group because we really care about internal succession and staying employee owned. That's the only way we see that we can avoid going down that PE path like a lot of other firms. All right, we have a couple minutes for more questions. 5 minutes here.
Where do you have the most success finding talent?
Network for us.
For us, it's been, we hired a recruiter. That's really helped. And having a national brand really helps. With COVID, we moved to a distributed workforce. It was really hard recruiting people when our home headquarters was Santa Barbara. It's a great place. It's beautiful, but it's expensive. So by moving to a distributed workforce, we can hire people wherever they are. And we have such a strong reputation for our culture. We've won a lot of top culture awards. Our comp, our benefits are super, super competitive. So it gets easier to hire after your first hire and your second hire, it gets much easier because then they can see how you take care of your teammates. They can see that others are thriving in the company. When you make your first hire, it's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. You got to go in through some ups and downs, but trying to get that hire that can stick is really key. And then from there, the third hire is easier, the fourth hire is easier. And now we have just a list of people that want to come in. We now are doing internship programs. From those internship programs, we're going to be bringing them in. We offer scholarships through the CFP board on the DEI side. So I'm speaking at the Diversity Summit in DC in October. So we'll have a lot of people that come to those things. So we have a lot of talent that's coming our right? And you can start to be more discerning. And the key part I would challenge everyone here is there's 70,000 CFPs in our industry, 45% will retire over the next 10 years. So it's on us to try to help improve what that future room will look like. And it's going to look different than this one, more female, younger, more diverse. We need to be part of that change.
And one other thing to highlight there, you can go location agnostic, which is how I'm calling virtual, really at any size, if it works for your firm, but it drastically improves your talent pool. We are 15 people, and we now have 2 in Missouri, 1 in New Jersey, 2 in Texas, 1 in California, and the rest of us in Colorado. We would not have gotten the talent that we have right now if we were geographically limited, even though we're a much smaller firm where a lot of our clients traditionally wanted in-person client meetings. So it's taken a lot of work, but the talent opportunity by doing virtual is big.
You mentioned you were avoiding the PE route. Why?
Well, as Michael talked about, PE is really rapidly changing our industry. And you know, the largest firms by far, we're the 100th largest firm by, you know, different metrics. The top 25 are growing exponentially. They're acquiring billion-dollar firms every month and just going like crazy. the challenge to that for the rest of us is that there's tremendous service expansion that's happening, right? They now have in-house tax departments, in-house estate planning departments, trust solutions, more alts, more ESG screens. They can do a lot because they have so much scale. So we see how they're shaping our industry, and we see the benefits from the client perspective in that you can get more services offered, typically for the same 1% or less AUM fee. And so we have to compete with that, right? All of us are competing with that. Now for us, we feel like our secret sauce is our culture and being able to be, you know, client focused, culture centric. And we don't want to go down a path where even if we very carefully picked a PE partner, and they're knocking on our door nonstop because we're one of the fastest organic growth firms in the country, we are worried, even if we found a PE partner we liked, who are they going to sell to in 5 years? Because they're all flipping, right? And then we have no control of our destiny 5 years from now, even if they're a minority partner. So yes, we'd love to have the capital because we could grow a lot quicker. We could get to that $30 billion in 3 years. But we don't want to do that at the expense of culture. So our mindset is, how can we keep growing, partnering with other like-minded firms that want to be partners, that want to be part of an employee-owned company? And we're doing that both with, you know, firms smaller than us and also talking about partnering with firms our size or larger. So I think there's going to be this Goldilocks opportunity in the middle for firms to be able to combine sources, say, look, we're going to be culture forward. We're still going to do client birthday cards. You're not going to tell us that we can't do this client cooking event, because we want to do that because we care about our clients. Where the PE firms are going to pinch and they're going to try to control culture. You're going to have a higher turnover because culture impacts turnover. And we just are committed to not going that route.
For those of us that maybe never get to that level, we don't want to be an enterprise, how do we differentiate ourselves? Or what advice do you have to us 5 years, 10 years as the industry keeps growing and expanding those services? You are an RC.
How do you compete? Well, I think it comes with partnerships. So we did a talk yesterday about buy to build. So each of you can partner with each other and find complementary skill sets. If you have a $100 million firm, there's maybe a peer as a $100 million firm, and you come together and offer more services based on that expanded expertise. That's one solution. I'm a big believer in life planning. So that's something that's uniquely human that these big firms really aren't doing. And that separates you from, you know, you're not going to build your own tax team. You're not going to build your own estate planning team. We have an estate planning attorney on hire, but we don't have a staff of 20 of them. We have a CPA on hire as our strategy team. We don't have, you know, 20 of them. But the work that we're doing in Inspired Living is really unique, and it provides unique experiences. It's a benefit to our advisors, and it feels great. So we feel like that's something that any firm, even if you're a one-person firm, you can start to do. That's a differentiator, and it's going to be hard for big PE-backed firms to ever try to match that. But if it comes to my value prop is I deliver financial planning and I create great 60-40 portfolios, I use SEI, I use BlackRock, and I have some DFA funds, zero differentiation.